There we are.
So you get a full slide every time. But this is not just about programming. This is also about the correctness proofs, including the complexity analysis, and not just on a piece of paper, but with the help of what is called a proof assistant. And we're using a particular proof assistant called Isabel. And what is a proof assistant? The ideal is that you give the proof assistant just the outline of the proof, the structure, and the proof assistant checks the correctness and fills in the missing steps. But you'll find that you wish it would fill in more missing steps, and sometimes you have to provide more detail than you ever wished for. And so that's why it comes with this health warning. It is time consuming. So in particular, in the first couple of weeks, it's a steep learning curve to use the system and to use it effectively. I'm warning you right in front. It's also potentially addictive. Once you have appreciated the rigor that this tool forces you to exercise, it undermines your naive trust in your own reasoning abilities, and you start to wonder at every step, is this really correct? And because sometimes you think something is correct, and then when you go into the details, you find out, no, it's not quite correct. And often the overall thing that you think is correct, but then when you start to elaborate on the individual steps, you get forget cases, it's not as formally correct as you thought it was. And when I talk about formal, I really mean machine checked in this course, so checked by the theorem prover. And when I talk of verification, then I mean a formal correctness proof of a program. And there are two landmark verifications that by now are more than 10 years old. In fact, I think the second one is just 10 years old. The first one is probably a few years older. One is of a C compiler, and the other is of an operating system kernel. And that has really shown people that software verification isn't just a dream, but that for critical pieces of software, it is actually achievable. Of course, this is a huge amount of work in both cases. So Xavier Loba probably spent like 4 or 5 years on this on his own. Gavin Klein had a lot of help from his research group, but also spent a couple of years on it. So this is a non-trivial exercise, but in the end, you get something that's really ultra-reliable. So there's been a recent paper where they tested a whole collection of C compilers out there, and the only one, surprisingly, that didn't really show any mistakes was this one. All the others, they found corner cases where the compiler went wrong, but the verified one didn't. Yeah, unsurprisingly. So what are you going to see in the course? For the first about 5 weeks, it'll be an introduction to the theorem prover Isabel, including already excursions into simple data structures, but it'll be more a general introduction to the system with some applications in the area that we're going to focus on. And then for the rest of the semester, we're really focusing on the data structures and the algorithms, and mostly it'll be search trees, priority queues, and complexity analysis, in particular amortized complexity, towards the end of the course, using the system. So initially, the system is in the foreground, and the application is just in the background, and then we flip, and the application comes into the foreground, and the system is in the background, in the sense that I will also start to use the system less and less in the in my lectures, and I'll do more things on the blackboard, and I'll assume you are then able, after 6-7 weeks, to make this transfer to figure out how to input into the system something I write less formally on the blackboard. And yes, so what I expect from you, okay, so it's already on this slide, what I said right up front. Some experience with a functional programming language, Ideally, in the ML and Haskell style, if it's Lisp, that's okay as well. It's just a bit more of a distance. Of course, I also expect that you have had a first course in data structures and algorithms, nothing very deep, and first course in discrete math, again, not terribly deep, but that you're familiar with the notation of logical formulas and sets and stuff like that. And yeah, this is, again, something I said right up front. And yeah, that's the end of the introduction. And since we are really, we have a lot on our agenda, I would like to jump right in and start to introduce you to the system that is the that will be with us for the rest of the semester. And we start with an introduction which is fairly programming oriented, but always accompanied by the proofs. And so I will give you first an overview of the system, that's today, and then in the next couple of weeks, how to define types and functions in general, how to do induction effectively, and how to use some of the proof tools effectively. So this is what we start out with today. It'll be, it always does that. Well, not always, almost always. Sometimes we're lucky, and it comes back. Yes, we're lucky today. I think we should find for the rest of the morning. It's 10, 15 minutes, that's the critical period. Start with an overview. First, a few words of notation. If you write this, or the system writes this, remember it's short for this. So it's an iterated implication, and logically, you can work that out using truth tables. Well, this is just the same as saying A and B implies C. This is just a more economic notation, the sense you just use one arrow and you don't need an AND, but you can think of it like an AND between the A and the B, and when I say similarly for other arrows, I mean that it associates to the right, that if you don't write any parentheses, you implicitly write those parentheses at the right end. And this is just another way of writing this. And here you can clearly see the AND intuition that if you have all of these facts here, A1 to AN, you can conclude B. So it's just a two-dimensional notation for an inference from a number of assumptions, A1 to AN, to a conclusion B. Right, so what is this system that we're using? It's Isabel, and Isabel is a generic theorem prover, but we're using a specific instance of it, and any instance for the logic HOL, which stands for higher order logic, and the somewhat simplifying equation that I usually use to introduce higher order logic is to say it's the same as a functional programming language plus logic. So what does that mean? It has the things that you expect in a functional programming language, namely data types, recursive functions, but it also has things that you expect in a logic, namely logical operators. So both of those are combined in the same notation. So of course, in programming language, you also have a bit of logic. You have an or, but you don't have quantifiers, for example, in a programming language normally, in particular not quantifiers over infinite sets. And you don't have real numbers as God made them, but you have the real numbers as some engineer at Intel made them. This is really what we have here is the idealized mathematical world plus the programming side of data types and recursive functions. And higher order simply means that the functions are values too, so you can pass around a function just like any other value. There's nothing special about them. Well, there is, of course, there's a little bit special. For example, you can't print out functions. But otherwise, in the programming logic, functions are not distinguished. And the formulas, well, we start out with very simple formulas. For the first lecture, almost all the formulas, with some exceptions, will be just equations between terms. So for example, an equation like that, 1 + 1 + 2 = 4. And then later on, we will introduce more of the logical vocabulary as we go along. And I assume you have seen that vocabulary already, I like to keep it simple at the beginning, just to ease the introduction to the system. Okay, so what are the types and terms of the language? So this is a typed language, HierOrderLogic. So every term has a type, and if the types go wrong, the system will not like it. So this is the basic syntax of the types, what kind of types we have in the system. So when you see a tau, you can always assume it stands for a type. So this is the, in grammar notation, the syntax. So what can a type be? It can be in parentheses. Then it can be any number of basic types. So in particular for this course, I think all we will need to know are these basic types, and in a few places the real numbers, but bool, nut, and int will suffice. And really, these are the natural numbers, not 32-bit integer numbers or something. Then we have type variables. So this is a what's called a polymorphic type systems, where types can have some flexibility. They're not fully instantiated yet. You can have type variables in them that stand for yet to be determined types. Then we have functions, and this is a bit of a speciality here. The function arrow is with a, written with a double arrow. And then we have pairs, cross tau, the cross in ASCII is simply the star. And we have lists. So tau lists are the type of lists over the component type tau. And similarly, you have tau set, the sets over the element type tau. And this is just a speciality of this syntax, that the list and the set operator comes after the argument. So in Haskell, you would write this list of tau or set and tau. But here it's just flipped. It's a postfix syntax. That's just a historic oddity. And these lists are finite lists, but these sets can be infinite. So these are really sets as the mathematicians gave them to us. And then the system is extensible. You can introduce further types as you go along. But these are the ones that the system already provides for you. And please interrupt me at any time if something is unclear. I'm very happy to engage in a dialogue. I should have said that right from the beginning. Right, those are the types. Then we have the terms. That's the actual values you can think of, except values are typically as only a subset of the terms. But what are the things that you can write down and compute with? This is the syntax of terms. A term, when you see a T, it typically stands for a term, can be parenthesized, and it can be some atomic thing, namely a constant that you've actually defined somewhere, or a variable, so just an identifier, and whether it stands for a variable or something that you have already defined, that depends on the context. Then you have function application, where you just write one term next to another term. That means the term on the left is applied to the term on the right, and the term on the left had better be a function. And lambda x dot t, that's function abstraction. That's how you generate a function that's how you write down a function that takes x as an argument and returns t as the result. And this is what's known in the trade as the lambda calculus, but there is lots of syntactic sugar, so the actual text that you write down looks much closer to a programming language and isn't quite as rudimentary as the syntax that you see there. And as I said already, it's a typed language, and terms must be well typed. Essentially, ignoring the lambdas, it means that whenever you apply a function to an argument, that argument must have the type of the argument type of the function. And this is the notation that's inherited from or borrowed from Haskell. That means the term T has the type tau, and this is the inference rule that corresponds to this line up here. The argument of every function call must be of the right type. So if you want to make sure that the application of the function t to the argument u is well typed and has type tau 2, well then the function t must be, the term t must be a function type that ends in t in type tau 2, and it must have an argument type tau 1, where u, the argument that you actually give it, must have that argument type. So that's the key idea that you always have to keep in mind. And with the lambdas, there is a bit more involved, but that's an intuition that I assume you have coming from a functional programming language. Yes, so as in languages of the ML and Haskell family, we have type inference. That means you don't need to write down all the types, but the system can, in most cases, infer the type of a variable or a function, and this is called type inference. So in particular, if you write the function definition f of x equals something, then the system can in principle infer what the type of the x is, but that's not a good idea. If you write down a function definition, please always add the type to it, and I won't even introduce the fact that that you can't. But on the other hand, if you write a big formula with lots of quantifiers, you don't need to give the type of every variable in the quantifier. It'll work those out. So it's just for documentation purposes to make it easier to read for people. The function definitions, they should have their types attached, but not everywhere else, because that gets too cumbersome. Now, there is one complication. Functions can be overloaded. And in those cases, the system will not always be able to work out what's going on. And then you may need what's called type annotations. So you explicitly insert in the term the type that something should have. So for example, you can write this here, f applied to x, and x is explicitly annotated with colon colon nat. So you are saying x should have type nat. What does that, why are we doing this? We are probably doing this because there are multiple definitions of f, one on the natural numbers, say, and one on the booleans, for example. And if you write just f of x, the system can't work out which one you mean, and therefore you have to explicitly say this. This is a corner case, and it's not completely corner case because lots of the basic operations on numbers are overloaded. So in that case, you get you have to be aware of this. But I don't recommend to define overloaded functions yourself. It just leads to confusion. So we're using it in some special cases, but try to avoid it otherwise. Currying is just a simplification of life. You should curry your functions, so please give your function this type and not this type. The two types are convertible. You can convert from one to the other. The drawback of this one is that the function f prime, when it's given a pair, you may need to actually extract the two parts of the pair using projection functions to get them out of the pair. It also means, for people who know about partial application, this function you can already apply to one argument of type tau 2, and that's fine. Here, this function can only be applied if both arguments are present. So it's also, it has a slightly, from a programming point of view, this is slightly more, slightly less convenient. So please always use this form of type for your functions. Of course, you can't do the same trick if the result type is a pair. Then you have to make it a pair, or you write two different functions, one which returns one part of the pair and the other which returns the other part of the pair. But that could be computationally inefficient if you want both parts. Then you can't completely avoid pairs, but at least in the argument position you should. And as I said, there's lots of predefined syntactic sugar. So we have infixes, we have something called mixfixes with an if then else and a case of, and we will introduce them as we go along, but I'm already introducing the if then else certainly, and I'm telling you two things about the syntax. I do actually appreciate if people come on time. So, two things about the syntax, since we are talking about if-then-else. The if-then-else and also the case should be enclosed in parentheses. So that's an oddity of the parser, because otherwise the parser doesn't really know where the else ends, and so that's why we're forcing parentheses around them. And the other thing that's standard in functional languages, but it's good to remind you, prefix application binds more strongly than infix. That means if you write this sequence of symbols, fx plus y, it means this, because the prefix application where you put the function in front of the argument, f of x, binds more strongly, so implicitly there are parentheses around it, than the infix plus. And it's not the same as this one. And you just have to remember that not to get into problems. But that one is standard here. That is non-standard. That was the nitty-gritty syntax at the bottom. Now we go one level up to something called a theory, and that's just Isabel speak for a module. A module containing what? It contains definitions, theorems, proofs, and many other things. And this is the syntax of such a module. It has a keyword theory and then a name of the theory. You import certain theories, T1 to TN. Then between begin end, you add new material to your theory. And here's a convention that if this is the name that you give your theory up there, then the theory must live in that file with THY as a suffix. So that's how you can tell it's an Isabel theory. And these are the names of the imported theories, and import is transitive, so you get everything that those theories import as well. And for many simple use cases, in particular for much of this course, you simply write imports main, and main is a name that we gave to the to a theory that imports or contains most of the basic material one wants. So it will contain the booleans, natural number, the reals, the integers, sets, lists, pairs, lots of discrete mathematics, relations. It also contain as the beginnings of real analysis, not too much in that direction. Main doesn't contain any. It doesn't contain the real numbers. They have to be. You have to get those specifically. So main is basically what you get in a course on discrete math. That's what one could say. Yes. So there's a little a complication here in terms of concrete syntax. In those theory files, terms, types, and formulas need to be enclosed in double quotes. So unless they are single identifiers. And I don't normally show those double quotes on the slides. So you will see them when we look at the examples. For the slide presentation, I will normally drop them. So how do we interact with the system? There is an interface, the standard interface to the Isabel system, and it's called Isabel JEdit. So it's a customization of the JEdit text editor, and like a Java or other modern IDE, when you read in the file, it starts processing it right away, and it'll immediately tell you, well, not immediately because it takes some time to process, but it'll tell you something, it didn't like something, and show you where errors are. And whenever you type, it'll stop processing, but when you then stop typing, it'll reprocess things. And I think at this point it's a good idea to actually look at the system in action. So let's see. Yes. No. Some of that doesn't work. I think, how do I get out of this? Now I've gotten out of it. And I want to load the overview demo. So the demo files are part of the repository that you should clone, and that contains all the material for this course. And now let's make this full screen. No, not like this? Okay. Yep. This is a bit small, the font. Let me increase this. I think, is it okay in the background now? Seems okay. Yeah, then let's use this. So this is an example of a theory, which I've just called overview demo, and it imports main. And here you can see some simple comments. This is a simple comment in this in the parentheses star style, and this is a more elaborate comment where you can also use LaTeX, but it's up to you what kind of style you prefer. And here, I think I don't want to show you everything yet, but what you can already tell here, so there are commands like text and term, and then there are formulae like here, and they are enclosed in double quotes. So here you see is an example of things being enclosed in double quotes. Now let me open this, because I don't want to see... I want to split the screen and go on output as well. And then it splits the screen, and in the upper part it shows me the input file, and in the lower part it shows me the system's answers, the system's reactions. So let's look at the reaction to this line here. What's this line? This line is a command. It says term and then some argument. The term command simply reads a term and gives you some feedback if the term could be parsed and type checked. And here we give it as an argument term, just the term true, which is the truth value, true. And the system figures that out correctly. Down there at the bottom, it echoes, I've parsed true, and I've figured out that it's a Boolean value. And the same with false. So you've now learned what the two truth values are and that they should be capitalized. So if you don't capitalize them, you can also do that and say, what's the term true with a lowercase true? And then you can already notice that the system prints the lowercase true in blue, but the uppercase true and false were printed in black. And that's the reaction of the system to recognizing that it's a predefined name. So true and false were predefined, they are printed in black. True with a lowercase t is completely unknown, and it's printed in blue saying, I'm a variable. The system doesn't know about my name yet, so it simply assumes that I'm a variable. And therefore, it also doesn't figure out the type, and it just gives it a generic type, namely the type variable A. I'm not going to pronounce those quotes. I'll just call the type variables A, B, and C. But in the ML tradition, the type variables have to be preceded by a quote to make them distinct from other type names. So without a quote, it should be a type name, a given existing type name with a quote. I mean this single quote here. It becomes a type variable. And you don't have to call them A, B, and C. You can call them quote anything. So here we have an example of something that the system assumes is a variable. Now in the next line, true and false, we have an example of a more complicated Boolean expression. And you can also see that there are different syntaxes for operators. So here we input the AND operator with the AND sign, but the system echoes it in the standard mathematical notation.
And on one of the slides to come, you will also see how to convert between, or how you can write it so that you directly on the input get a nice symbol. And again, the system works out that it's a Boolean term. On the next line, true and false is also a Boolean term, although false has become a variable. It's not a known symbol. Why is the whole term true? Well, because it's combined with an AND. And so the system will even figure out that the little false in blue must be of type bool, although it hasn't been declared. Why? Well, because it's an argument to an AND operation. And you can ask the system, well, please tell me what is the type of one of the constituents, one of the names in a formula. On my Mac, I have to go to Command and then hover over it. And then the system will say, oh, false is a free variable and it's of type bool. So these pop-up menus come up whenever you hover over a name in a formula. Not just names, also things like AND. Here, if you hover over AND, it says it's a constant. Now, you may be confused by the word constant because most of you are used to constants being things like 1, 2, and 3. In the terminology here, constant is simply something that has been defined. It can be a function of arbitrary type. It just means constant in the sense that the logarithm function is the same constant function today as it is tomorrow. It doesn't change. That's why it's called a constant in contrast to a variable. So I will call them functions, but the standard terminology in lambda calculus simply those are constants as opposed to the variables that haven't been defined anywhere. But AND has been defined. And in fact, if you click on it, it should even take you to the place of definition, but yes, it does. Not that this is very readable, just in case you are interested in looking at the internals of the system, this is actually the definition of AND. This may be a bit surprising, maybe at the very end I'll have time to talk a little bit about the background logic, but this isn't a logic course, so we simply go back. We simply assume that the symbol is called AND, then it is the AND that we're all used to. We're not going into the logical foundations here. You can also evaluate terms. That works well for simple terms. If you have a term with a quantifier in it, then evaluation will typically not do very much. But if you ask, for example, what's the value of true and false, then the system will say it's false. And you can also ask sometimes, it doesn't always work, value of terms containing variables, like what is the value of true and p, and the system will say p. On the other hand, if you ask what's the value of p and p, then it'll just say p and p. So it's not a complete simplification procedure because there is, for the Boolean terms, there is no unique normal form. It just tries to do something that works reasonably well. On the other hand, if it's something that doesn't contain any variables and all the functions in there are executable, then it really executes it and gives you the same value that a functional programming language does. But this true and p is not something that you can ask in a functional programming language. We're going towards symbolic evaluation, and then things always get incomplete. Then we did have I did mention overloading, and here's the example. If you write down n plus n equals 0, the system will figure out that it's a Boolean term because the equality forces it to be of result type Boolean, but it won't figure out what the type of n is. And if you now hover over the n, it'll say it's a free variable of type A. Why is that? Because the plus is overloaded. So there are multiple pluses, and the system doesn't know which one you mean. And so then you have to write things like n of type nat plus n equals 0, and then it'll pick the right plus and also the right 0 because there are multiple zeros. Yeah, these are just examples of type inference, but This is something that should be known from a functional programming course, so I don't want to spend any additional time on it. So it's just, if you write something like f of g of x and y, the system will give those functions some types. So for example, the type f, it will figure out that f must be a two-argument function, not too surprisingly. So if you ask it, says, oh yes, f is a free variable, hasn't seen f before, and it's of type a to b to c, whatever a and b and c may be, those are again type variables. So the system will figure these things out. Unless you have overloading, then it'll typically just make it a type variable and you're not any wiser. Let's go back to the slides. And now I want to introduce by example the three basic types that will be with us for all of the course: the Booleans, the natural numbers, and the lists. I think I want this one. Yes, that's better. The type bool could have been defined, but it's not defined like that, as a data type, so you already see another keyword. So you can introduce new types, in this case a data type, an algebraic data type, a non-recursive one, which is just an enumeration. You say the type of booleans is equal to the type that contains these two elements, true and false. And then the system predefines lots of functions on booleans. So and or and implication are nothing special. They're just functions or constants that all have this type bool to bool to bool, because they're all binary. And formulas are again nothing special. They're just a specific type of terms, namely the terms of type bool. So that's what sets the formulas apart, that they have this separate type of booleans. And there is the syntax for if and only if. The default syntax for if and only if is the equality. So if you write an equality between Boolean formulas, it doesn't mean that those two Boolean formulas have to be syntactically identical. It just means that they imply each other in both directions. And as I said before, those are predefined functions, and we're not looking at the definitions. They behave the way you expect them to behave. This is how the data type of natural numbers could have been introduced, namely, again, as a data type. You introduce data type called nat, and now it's not just an enumeration, because the natural numbers have infinitely many values. You can't enumerate them, but you can write them down recursively. You can say, what is a natural number? Well, it can either be zero, or it can be the successor of a natural number. So that's the compact syntax for introducing a recursive data type. And what do you implicitly generate when you write this? You generate, you define the natural numbers to be all the values of the form. It's either zero or successor of zero or successor of zero, and so on. So it's an extremely simplistic, logical way of modeling the natural numbers. And that's, in fact, the way when at the turn of from the 19th to the 20th century, when mathematicians, or logicians more likely, wondered how to give simple logical meaning to notions like numbers, that's what they started with, this unary notation for the numbers. This is not very efficient, but it's logically very nice. There is an alternative efficient binary notation in the system, but that just complicates life. And this is, we're mostly talking about reasoning here, and efficient implementation is of numbers is a somewhat separate issue. Then we have lots of predefined functions again, addition, multiplication, and many others that take two natural numbers and give you back a natural number. All of this stuff up here, all of this here, all of these binary functions are overloaded. In particular, the numerals are overloaded. So we do have numerals 0, 1, 2, and so on. And if you write those numerals, by default, there's no fixed type for them. Same as for the plus
doesn't really have this type. This is what I claimed up there. The real type of the plus is this. And you have to somehow tell the system which plus you mean. And sometimes you need to say this explicitly. For example, you need to write, I need the one from the natural numbers, or I want the addition on the natural numbers, and you can enforce this by making one of the arguments the natural numbers. But sometimes you're lucky, if you write successor of z, then sub of z, there is no mistaking. There is only one unoverloaded function symbol called suck. So if you write suck of z, it means you force that particular function, and therefore that implicitly forces z to be a natural number. But with a plus, the same thing doesn't work. So with a plus, you have to explicitly say so. But typically, there's enough context around that will ensure that you get the right types. But most of the mistakes that beginners make is in this area of types, that they write something and they think it's something, but the system thinks it's something else. So whenever you there's something odd happening, then it's good to examine the types. You've written down some formula, and the formula may pass and may type check, but some of the variables in that formula may have a different type than what you expected. Now let's look at an example of a more interesting theory file that actually introduces some more material. No. Yep. This worked. Not. Where are we? So this is a little theory that again builds on main, and it defines the addition function. We have the addition function already in the system, and it's called plus. But just for the as an example, I am showing you another definition. And so this is the syntax for function definitions. It starts with the keyword fun, then we have the name of the function, then colon, colon, its type. And remember, types and terms must be enclosed in these double quotes, unless they are so simple that they are just single identifiers. But this is not a single identifier, this is a longer type. And then the where keyword that separates the header of the function definition from the recursion equations. So here we have two recursion equations. One tells us that how addition behaves if the first argument is zero, it just returns the second argument. And the second one tells us how addition behaves if the first argument is a successor of some number, then you just pull the successor outside and add recursively the number m inside with the second argument n. So this is just a simple, logically correct definition of addition. Not very efficient, but for logic, for reasoning principles, very nice. These defining equations have to be separated with a vertical bar. Question about that function definition? Any kind of question about it? Okay, then let's look at a lemma. So this is how we actually state and then prove, in this case, a simple inductive property of this function, namely that if the second argument is zero, we return the first argument. So we don't have to state this. This function definition is complete as it is. It tells you completely what happens with addition by recursion on the first argument. But here we find that if the second argument is zero, we also return the first argument. And how do we prove this? We prove this by induction on M, and then we apply the function auto. So what's going on here? So let's first go to the line directly after the statement of the lemma. And down here in the output window, if you tick proof state, you will see that the system's response to your proof actions. So here you've just stated the lemma, and it says you're about to prove something, and your current goal, which is consists only of one sub-goal, is the thing that you wrote down here. So this is how it will always start. You have one sub-goal that you're trying to prove, and then you apply commands of the system to that proof state, and it will change, and typically you'll create multiple sub-goals, and then eventually you will prove them all, and you'll be done. So if you do now the second command, you say, I want to do this by induction on M, what happens? The proof state that was generated here is acted on by this induction command, which says, okay, induction means you have to prove two things, induction on M. One is this statement where M is zero, that becomes this statement, and the second one is an implication where we assume that the statement we're trying to prove holds, and we have to prove it for a number that's one larger, the successor of the M that we have here. And that's one of those little undergraduate exercises when you are introduced to induction. And now we say auto, and the system will just prove it. I will later on explain why this is so simple that the system could prove it very easily on one of the slides. Typically, you'll be very happy if the system proves things automatically and you will no longer want to know the details, but we will look at the details in a moment. And yeah, this is a simple example of defining a function and proving a simple property about it. Questions so far? And it's not always going to be that easy. So let's go back here. This is the same proof, but now written how you might write it, still quite precisely, but informally. So this is what we want to prove, and we want to prove it by induction on M. And then we have a case zero, the base case, where we replace M by zero, and this equation holds just by definition of addition. Add, if the first argument is zero, the second argument is returned, which is zero. So this is by definition of add. Then you have a case successor of M, the induction step. We assume that what we're trying to prove already holds, and we call that the induction hypothesis. And then we need to show that this statement where M has been replaced by M plus one, except the system calls it suck M, this is what we need to prove. And we start from the left end. And what do we do? In the first line, by definition of addition, we pull the successor out of the first argument around the addition function. And what do we do now? Well, now we have add of zero and m and zero, and we can remember our induction hypothesis. And then we say, okay, this is equal to suck of m by induction hypothesis. So this is essentially all the system has done, and it's so simple the system could do it automatically. Many of our proofs will be of this nature, except they will typically be much longer. The chains of equations will be longer. And typically, you will also need additional lemmas to prove so that this proof goes through. We'll see examples of that in a moment. But in principle, there's no magic going on here. The system doesn't know about magic, unfortunately. You often wish it would. And now comes the last and probably the bread and butter data type for functional programmers, lists of elements of some arbitrary element type A. And this is how the lists are actually defined in the system. Why did I say the Booleans could be defined like this, the natural numbers could be defined like that, but they're not? It's because the system, there's a long bootstrapping process, and at the point where the Booleans are defined, this this infrastructure for defining data types isn't in place yet. And similarly for the natural numbers, once those are in place, then there's a really quite a huge infrastructure for defining these data types, and that we can now use in order to define the lists. So what are we saying here? We're introducing a new type, and we're calling the type list, and we're saying, but it's a type that has an argument type called A, namely the type of the components of the lists. And what does a list look like? Well, it can either be nil, that's our code for empty list, or it can be a cons operator applied to first an element and then the remainder list. So this is the what is often called the head and the tail of the list. So this would be the head of the list, the first element, and the tail of the list is the remainder of the list. And so here we have some example lists. Nil is certainly a list, but cons 1 nil, cons 1, cons 2 nil will also be lists. So any nesting of conses which terminates with a nil will be a list, and you should think of those lists as lists that enumerate the elements one after the other, and at the end we have a final nil. There is in the system predefined in main, there is syntax for nil. You can just write open square bracket, close square bracket, and that will stand for nil, the empty list. And the syntax for the cons operation is the hash syntax. So if you write x hash x's, then that's just short for cons x x's. So this is where the head and tail become quite visible. Head x, tail x's. And please, also in your homework, try to follow this nice convention that lists should be called things like x's and y's and z's, because there is type inference, so often not all the types will be visible, and it's very helpful for a reader to see, oh, x is here, that must be a list. Please try to take that on board. Finally, we have this notation for longer lists. So that's just a shorthand for lots of hashes terminating with a nil. So this is the standard syntax that you also... This is the standard syntax from functional languages. In Haskell, this would be the hash would be the colon. In ML and OCaml, it'd be the colon colon. So there's a certain amount of variety. Question about lists in principle? Now, we already saw a simple example of proof by induction on natural numbers. That was unsurprising because it corresponds exactly to what you're used to from any discrete math course and induction on numbers. Now, induction on lists is something that some people may have not have come across. So this is the idea of structural induction for lists. So how does that work? You have some property P, some formula that contains a variable x's, a list variable, and you want to show that this formula P of x's is true for all lists. So what do you have to prove? Structural induction for list means you have to prove that the property is true for the empty list and that it is preserved by adding an element in front of the list. So that P of x's implies P of x cons x's, so that if you already know the property is true for x's, you can deduce that it's true for any list that's one longer than x's, that has one more element in front of it. And this will be for arbitrary but fixed x and x's. So you have local x and x's in there. And this is how the system, this is how this inference rule is stored in the system or formulated in the system. So this is the formula version of this informal text here. So you want to prove P of x's for all x's, then you have to prove it for the empty list, and you have to prove this implication. And this bit here is the corresponding to for arbitrary but fixed x and x's. I will say more about this big and sign as we go along. So these induction principles are simply, again, formulas in the system. You will not need to look at the formulas, but I'm just, as one example, I'm showing you the induction command isn't just some magic, but it really only uses some predefined or pre-proved, to be more precise, formula, the induction formula for lists. And now we will see an example of that in action. And this is where I need your help, because we will prove something, but oops, that's not what I wanted. Let's go back here. No. This is okay now. Where are we? Yes, there we are. List demo. So here we're going through a demonstration of the proof process and on lists, but in order not to get confused by the already predefined lists, we define our own lists. So main already contains lists, but we define them again. We're shadowing the ones in main. And you will see that now if you ask what is nil, the system will say, it's a value of type demo list.list, and it's called demo list.list.nil. So this is the result of having two things of the same name in scope. And although one is being shadowed, the system thinks you may not realize that you're shadowing something, and I'm now giving you the long names to make you aware of this. However, the long names are tedious. We don't want to see them. That's why I'm giving the explicit command short names. So this is just something very special for this example, and you can already forget about it. But if you start seeing those long names, you see that's an indication that the same name already existed in the system, and you may want to choose a different name. And now we have two function definitions. The first one is the application, the append function, that takes two lists and puts one list in front of the other. And it is a bit small. Let's make it a bit bigger. And it's similar to the addition function, but there's more structure there because we're not in the natural numbers, it's just the number. There's nothing inside the number. So to speak, here we have things inside. If the first argument is nil, the empty list, well, putting the empty list in front of anything gives us that anything. If the first argument is a cons, well, then you pull out the first element of that cons, put it at the very beginning of your list, and then you append recursively the tail of that list with the second argument. So this is the standard recursive way of running down the first list and pulling out all the elements one by one and putting them in front of the resulting list. So this will realize the append function correctly. And I also want to define a reverse function, but let's think about that one for a moment. I mean, for those of you who have got the laptop open and are looking at exactly this, there's not so much thinking. The reverse function are supposed to reverse the order of elements in the list, and it's clear that reverse applied to nil. We don't have the special syntax here. The special syntax is only attached to the predefined list, so I really have to write nil and cons, and I'm doing it intentionally to make absolutely clear what's going on. Reverse of nil is nil. That's pretty obvious. So how do we define reverse of the list that starts with an x and continues with x's? Any suggestions from the audience?
Yeah,
the very back.
Okay. I'd say tons of parentheses, reverse from X. Partial dx.
No sounds of pain in the audience? Yes, so this has to be a list, otherwise, see, the cons operation expects an element and a list, but you are giving it a list and an element. So that doesn't quite work, but you're on the right track. So how can we improve on this? Yes?
We use the append and we put x into this.
Yes, so we just need this to make this into a single element list. So how do we do this?
With a bracket.
We don't have that syntax, so you have to tell me explicitly.
Cons x, no.
Yep. That's it.
And that's what we see here as well. Yes?
Can we actually use the concatenation operator in your function definition, the x hashtag xs, because we did not define that operator for our own list.
Oh. Yes, indeed. I'm very sorry. Oops. Kidding.
Thank you. Can't use that. Have to write cons.
And then you can, just to see if you've done, if your definitions make sense, you can ask things like, what's the value of reverse of cons and true and cons and false and nil? And so that's the two-element list with true, false, and then the terminating nil. And luckily, the system will say, yes, it's cons, false, cons, true, nil. So apparently, we've done the right thing. And you can also do this symbolically here. For example, you can ask yourself, or ask the system, what's ref of cons A, cons B, nil? And the system will say cons B, cons A, nil. But again, where sort of this is borderline, with these simple functions, it'll work. For more complicated functions, you may not get an interesting answer with symbolic questions. Okay, and now comes the thing we really want to prove, that if we reverse a list twice, we get the original list back. Starting only from the definitions, we don't have any other properties, and it will turn out that we need more properties, but those will be for you to find. So we start with a standard induction, with a standard proof heuristic that tells us if we want to prove something about a recursively defined function, chances are that we will need induction. And so this is what we're doing. And in this case, there is no question what to induct on. There is only a single variable, so let's do induction on that one. So we start with ref of x is x's. So we see it down here as the one and only subgoal. And then we said, please do induction on x's, and we will get two subgoals, one where x's has been turned into nil. That's the first one. Well, that one will be very easy to prove. And the second one is the induction step, where we assume that what we have to prove is already true, and we now have to prove it for a list that's one longer, where we have put the x1 in front of the x's with the cons operator. And we will now be very naive about it, because we have enough intuition to think, yeah, this should work. We'll just ask the proof tactic or proof method auto, and auto will do something. And as you can see, if you look from here to here, there's one fewer subgoals, namely the first subgoal disappeared and the second one became the first subgoal, but the remaining subgoal is not very nice. So the induction hypothesis has stayed unchanged, but it has done something to the conclusion. The conclusion isn't what we used to have. So this is, this is what we had. It looks like what we're trying to prove, rev of rev, but then a const term inside is equal to that const term, but then auto tried to prove it, but only got that far and then stopped and said, this is as far as I got. Does that help you? And indeed, if you start staring at it, and if you have a certain amount of experience, then what auto leaves you will often be an indication of what additional properties are needed to get the proof through. So you will now have to look at this and say, how could we possibly prove this implication, this conclusion here with our induction hypothesis and possibly additional properties of the two functions reverse and append? And it turns out we do need another property. This proof cannot continue without it. And it's your intuition I'm asking for, what additional property could be helpful here. And there's a little bit of a heuristic that you can use. You can, because you want to use the induction hypothesis. The induction hypothesis is only applicable if you have rev of rev, two revs next to each other. Here, in the situation that we've now got, the two revs are not next to each other. They are apart. So maybe we need some property of rev and app that helps us to move them closer together again so that we can eventually apply the induction hypothesis. So now maybe somebody has an idea what could be helpful in this situation. And it's really a property not of a single function, but of the combination of rev and app. I would turn it around. Not how to append reversed list, but
maybe you can define rev in another way?
No.
not here, but how to reverse appended lists.
Yes, so that will work better, how to reverse appended lists. And I'll say a word why your suggestion in principle works, but it's in practice it won't work well. So how to reverse two appended lists. So what do you think that would be? Maybe you?
I think maybe we append them first and then we reverse.
Append, reverse, which ones?
Not sure.
Why is first?
And you were thinking in this direction, from here to here. This direction is more useful or simpler because the system always tries to do things left to right and use equations from left to right. This is a simpler left-hand side that will match more easily. This is a more complicated right-hand side that will match fewer cases. So, and in particular, this will match the situation that we have up there. But that's, of course, I'm already using knowledge about how the system works, a knowledge that you'll have to build up, and in particular, this realization that equations are, in the proof process, almost always used from left to right. And certainly auto only uses that from left to right, and therefore you have to formulate your lemmas accordingly so that auto can then use them. We'll say more about these heuristics as the course progresses. So let's have a lemma. So that was rev of app of x's and y's equal to app of rev of y's and rev of x's. And now you should always give lemmas names, otherwise you can't use them later on. So let's call this rev app. And how do we prove it, or how do we try to prove it?
Induction.
On axis. Right. And here there's already a choice. You could do induction on X's or on Y's. Why do we are we doing induction or trying induction on X's? Let's do it. In principle, both seem possible, but there's a heuristic argument that tells us that X's is probably better, because X's appears here, and that's the recursion argument of the append function. Append is defined by induction over the first argument. And so if you do induction on X's, I know that we will be able to do something with this subterm here. If, on the other hand, you do induction on Y's, nothing will happen here. You won't be able to simplify this term here, and therefore it's probably not helpful to do induction on Y's. You may argue, but here, then you can simplify this term. That's true, but just heuristically speaking, if you do induction on X's, you have this subterm can be simplified and this one can be simplified, whereas if you do induction on Y's, only this one can be simplified. So there's a bit more going on if you do induction on X's. This is completely heuristic. And the proof process is heuristic. It's not a decidable problem. I'm just giving you some of my intuition that if you do induction on a variable, it helps. If there's a choice, it helps to do induction on a variable which is in the recursive position in of as many functions as possible in that problem, in that formula. And I'm not even going to look at it. I'll just say, okay, let's see what auto can do. And in this case, it's very disappointing what auto could do. It couldn't even prove the base case. We are still left with two cases, the simplified or manipulated base case, and the induction step is still with us. So let's not even look at the induction step before we could prove the base case. What's wrong? Why couldn't the system prove the base case? What is missing? There's nothing wrong here, but something is missing. Some lemma.
Same as.
Yes.
Same as.
Yes, so again, for the append function, we have this property. If the second argument is nil, then it just returns the first argument. And if we have that property, then, of course, this term here collapses to rev of nil, and then we have, rev of y's, and we have rev of y's equals rev of y's. Sorry, I think I need to. So let's try this. Lemma, append x's and nil equals x's. No question what to induct on. So we, in fact, I will copy induction and auto. And it says no subgoals. Great. At that point, you're really happy. You just write done. Oops. But now you want to use this lemma. Now, it should certainly have a name. Let's call it appNil2. And there are two ways of using it. You can either use it explicitly further down by mentioning it in the proof process, or you can use it implicitly and for a statement like this that you always want to use that statement whenever you see a list of this form where the second argument is nil. You want to throw away that second argument. So you can do that by, in parentheses, saying simp, which means please, in many, not all of the proof methods, always use this lemma as a left-to-right simplification rule. And this is what we're doing. And now, if we now go back to, this is the lemma that we tried to prove and where we needed this appNil2 property. We do induction. We have the base case. And in the previous attempt, after auto ran, we were left with the modified base case. Now the base case has disappeared and we're just left with the induction step. And the induction step is as we're used to. So here we have the property that we're trying to prove. we can assume that for those specific lists, X's and Y's, and this is a mangled version of the induction step. So this is somehow what we're trying to prove after simplification, but it's not quite the identity. The two lists that we have on the left and the right side of the equality are fairly similar. In particular, we first have the list ref of y's, then we have the list ref of x's, and then we have the singleton list x1. So things are in the right order, but somehow the two terms are not identical. What are we missing? Yeah.
Associativity.
Yep. Append is associative, and so we can shift the append function around. And if we do that, for example, if we shift this append one further to the right, then the two terms become identical. And so we do need this as an additional lemma. Asoc. And of course, since we know the system tries to use things from left to right, you may be wondering which way round should we orient the append as an associativity rule. There is no wrong or right here. You just should commit to one or the other, and I'm committing to this one. So you can, without changing the order, but you can change the parentheses how the three lists X, Y's, and Z's in what order they are put together. Whether we first combine these two and then append the Z's, or whether we first combine these two and then append the X's to the front. And now, of course, we have three variables in our formula. So there's a potential for induction over all three of them. But which one would you prefer here?
X's,
because X's appears twice in the recursive position. Here we have x's in the recursive position, and here we have x's in the recursive position. Whereas if you induct over y's, it's not going to do much good on the whole left-hand side. It'll only help here. And if you induct on z's, it will not be any help at all, because z's only appears in the second argument of append, which is the non-recursive argument. And so if you, just to make this clear, if you look at the definition of append, you can only... you can only use these equations from left to right if the first argument has the form of nil and cons. If you don't know anything about the first argument, you won't be able to use those equations. So that's why in the induction you should do something that makes those first arguments nil and cons. So let's go back here. Append is associative. Okay, let's again copy our template. And it worked. Let's not look at the detail. It worked fine. And it's not, as long as you have it becomes worrying if there's a statement that you don't believe yourself and the system can prove it. But if you believe it and you have an intuition about it, then let's not worry about the details. Now, with associativity, you might wonder whether you always want that as a simplification lemma that's always applied from left to right. Maybe not, because it's not really simplifying things, it's just regrouping them, and that may or may not help. So let's use this as an example to show how to use a lemma explicitly. This is the next block is what we were trying to prove, where we could get the base case but not the induction step. And this is where we needed the associativity of append. And we can instruct auto to do this locally in this one proof by just saying, oh, please use the simplification rule app asoc. Oops. And then that will go through. So this is an example how you can modify the proof method auto, and this is just a modifier of auto. It says, please take this into account as well, this lemma here, app asoc. Please always also use that in your simplifications, and then the auto method managed to prove both the base case and the induction step. And I don't like the built-in indentation, so that's why I'm always undoing it. Now we've done this. We have ref of app. That's another example. I'm not sure you always want to replace every term of this form by this term. So let's not do that. Let's just leave it as it is. But now we've proved it. We're done with the proof. We can use it in the final theorem, in the proof of the final theorem, the ref of ref proof. If you remember, that didn't work. The induction got stuck here, and then we looked at it and we argued, oh yeah, you want to bring those two refs here closer together, and maybe this lemma here that we have helps us, so we can see if it helps us. By the way, we can also see, without even looking at the bottom of the screen, you can see that this proof here did not succeed. So there's a red exclamation mark, and against the done, that's the system's way of saying this proof command failed. And the done command failed. Why? Because you were saying, I'm done with my proof at the point where you still had something to prove. The system doesn't like that. But if you now say, please also add this simplification rule locally. Which one was it? Ref app. Now it says no subgoals, and also the done here is accepted. So this was a somewhat lengthy example of the proof process that you will have to face in the during the lecture, that often starts just with one statement, and then in the proof you find, oh, I also need to prove this statement, I also need to prove that statement. It's typically not as long a process as here. Here we needed to invent and prove three additional lemmas. That's typical for a situation where there's nothing yet. There's no library. You've just started to define two functions, but you don't have any properties. Then it's not surprising that you need more than one property. But on the example sheets, it's typically that you may need one or at most two lemmas. So let's just recap what we've seen. This, by the way, is an informal proof, I mean natural language proof with all the details, to prove the associativity of append by induction on axis. And these are all the two cases, nil and cons, the induction hypothesis, and here is the sequence of steps that you need to go through and prove it. So you can always write out these proofs, and you should initially, for your own benefit, you should not just rely on auto, but in one or two cases just see, well, what really happened, step by step, follow it. And here's the step by step, with saying every step justified by a definition, the induction hypothesis, or again by a definition. So this example is misleading because we're building up everything from scratch. In the rest of the course, you should not define your own list. Don't reinvent, reuse. So use the lists that are already part of main, or more precisely in the source directory of the Isabel distribution. The lists live in hol, that's the whole hol logic, plus, and then in the sub theory, list.theory. And in particular, the ones that you should be aware of are the append function that's written as an infix at some more, the length function, the map function, the filter function, and the set function that converts a list into a set. So I assume from a functional programming course you know what map and filter are, and set is self-explanatory, the conversion from a set to a list. So they will come up in the exercise sheets, and that's why I'm mentioning them here. And this brings us really to the end of the course, and more about the rich infrastructure that the system already provides next time. Any last questions? Yep.
Can you combine demos in our tools? We use only one demos.
No, you can have a list of lemmas. You can say auto simp colon lemma 1, lemma 2, lemma 3. Okay, in that case, that's it for today, and see you next week.